Yeah. Ain't got no jewelry on, still I'm shining hard. Ain't got no bodyguard, walking solo through the mall. Bitches and the hoes know they see me, they like, there he go. They be like, there he go, school boy, there he go.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 8 of the Cracked Podcast. I'm Jack O'Brien, I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and I'm joined by Cracked's head writer, creative director, presidential expert of no relation, Daniel O'Brien.
Hello.
Daniel has a book coming out called How to Fight Presidents, based around all this weird knowledge he has of presidents from growing up locked in the biography section of a local library. Is that correct?
That's where I was raised. Yeah.
Yeah. That's your origin story. Hey, we're tying it back. All right. So before we get to the specific president that we're going to be discussing today, I want to explain sort of what kind of presidential expert Dan is. Because I think when people hear presidential expert, their first thought is, okay, here comes a guy who I could probably take in a street fight, right?
Sure, that's a standard across the board for most presidential experts.
Right, they're picturing a guy on the History Channel with glasses, yeah, wearing a fancy blazer.
That weak-ass David McCulloch.
Exactly. And, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into physical description here, mostly because I can't imagine that's all your blood on the karate gi you're wearing right now, Daniel. And I don't want to say anything incriminating, but you're sort of a different type of presidential expert. You're a presidential historian by way of Rennie Harlan or Shane Black or other action movie director, writer, guy. So let's talk a little bit about your book. As the name suggests, it teaches people how to fight real presidents from history, right?
Every president who is dead, this will teach you how to fight them and beat them up when they were alive. And it was because when I was a freshman in college, I had an American government teacher who started off the class saying, "Hi, everyone. I can't get fired because I'm tenured. I just want you all to know no one in this room is ever going to be president." And I got really mad about that. So I was like, I'm going to show this asshole. I'm going to be president all over this stupid country and tell him to suck it. And then I'm going to resign. So I started reading about presidents to see what they all had in common that I could ape and then start on my path to becoming president. And in doing so, I realized that I couldn't because they were all absolutely crazy. They were super fascinating, but every single one of them was an egomaniac of absurd proportions, some previously, still currently actually, undiagnosed specific form of mental illness that they all share. I didn't have.
But I thought that story was going to end with a twist where you did become president.
No, I did not yet. And certainly the research into this book is going to be very incriminating if I ever decide to run. But my plan, since I couldn't be president, I was going to make sure I could beat them all up, because that's, I think, a more noble goal to set for yourself.
And harder than I think most people think. I mean, most of us learned most of what we know about presidents in elementary and middle school when we were still too young to get into R-rated movies. So our knowledge of presidents is somewhat PG-rated, right? It's the edited for network TV version.
Network is even generous, because it's not even just that we get the soft version. We get the least interesting or exciting parts of all these presidents. You ask a kid about George Washington, like, oh, first president, dollar bill. And everyone knows the story of the cherry tree. And that's not even true. And there are so many other things about George Washington that are way more impressive and exciting than that.
So it's more almost edited for Saturday morning cartoon version. It's just really stupided down, as the saying goes.
Washington reportedly loved the sound of bullets whizzing by his head. He found like a poetry in that. So he was always in battle and like wrote letters to his brother about, I just really like being out here, and like the sound of bullets whizzing by is really soothing to me. And then King George heard about that, was like, oh, I bet he'll change his mind when he hears one or two more. And George Washington was like, oh, funny joke, asshole. And then he won and destroyed.
He just built America. Defeated them.
Washington's death is one of my favorite things, because the doctors were trying to keep him alive for as long as possible because he was George Washington. And he just decided, no, that's enough. He sent the doctors away because they're like, do you want us to keep you alive a little bit longer? No, this is fine. Get out of here. And he died taking his own pulse.
Really?
Yeah.
You've written about Andrew Jackson on the site before, and I don't want you to give away all the goods from your book, but I do also want you to give away. No, but just something that totally changed my impression of history was this idea that the most powerful man in the world was constantly getting into shootouts.
Yeah, historians are in disagreement over how many duels he'd actually participated in. But enough that historians can be in disagreement of it. Like, that's right. That's a good enough number for me, that it was more than certainly all presidents, more than you and I, more duels than people should be in, frankly.
Right. He murdered people.
He murdered a lot of people. And he
Not like at war, in like personal disputes.
No, just someone was like, hey, Jackson, I heard your wife died. And he's like, you son of a bitch. One of my favorite duels of his, he gave his opponent the first shot, which is an insane thing to, I don't know for our listeners at home if you guys do a lot of duels, but that's a really poor strategy. Ideally, you want to be the only one who shoots in a duel. And Jackson was like, no, go ahead and go for it. I'll give you one. Better make it count because I'm Andrew Jackson. And the guy shot and hit Jackson. He was like, well.
He hit him?
Yeah, but not hard enough. So Jackson shot and killed him.
His bullet wasn't fast enough.
Yeah.
And that guy's on our money.
Andrew Jackson is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Not the
guy he shot and killed.
So we're going to look at a president who most people know for two things. They know him as the guy who was sworn into office after JFK was assassinated and the Vietnam guy. And he's in that picture next to Jackie Kennedy.
Or maybe our readers know none of this.
Yeah.
And this is all new information. His name is Lyndon Johnson.
You guys are probably all idiots, right? Yeah, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson. So we found out during Watergate that U.S. presidents have been secretly recording their conversations for apparently years. But in 1992, 20 years after LBJ's presidency, over 20 years, his tapes were unsealed earlier than expected. We'll get into why that was a little bit later. But when they were unsealed, it was revealed that Johnson had been obsessively creating these secret recordings of his phone conversations as president. The Nixon tapes kind of get most of the attention because Nixon was a crazy person, and he had installed sound-activated microphones in every room of the White House. But Johnson was kind of the first person to take the secret recording thing to creepy, obsessive levels. He didn't come up with the idea. FDR, actually, was the first person to secretly record meetings. Kennedy would record meetings and phone calls about official policy. Eisenhower did it too, I think, 25 different meetings. It was the thing presidents were doing to keep record of their most important meetings. But Johnson recorded 9,000 phone calls, 800 hours worth of phone calls. That's 33 days of conversations that he was secretly recording. And as we're about to hear, a lot of the time, these were personal conversations that had absolutely nothing to do with policy. It wasn't like he just had a tape recorder constantly going. Every time he would get on the phone, he had to make the conscious decision to look to his secretary and make a little gesture with his, a little curlicue gesture with his finger that indicated to his secretary, all right, I want to record this one.
Yeah.
We should be getting this. And so they would record various phone conversations. And then creepily, he would have transcripts made and read them back, read every phone conversation he had during that day at night in bed.
Right. And listeners are probably assuming that the conversations that he's having recorded are like, oh, here he is talking with a prime minister, or here he is talking with a congressman or somebody else important. And he did record those, but he also very specifically wanted recordings with his barber and his tailor and his anything, any lowest status you could think of, Lyndon Johnson. If he thought it was going to be a good phone call, he wanted it on record.
Yeah, and for some reason, he thought this clip that we're about to listen to was something that he wanted on his permanent record, that he had a transcript made of, and that he read back to himself before going to sleep. It is a conversation with the guy who makes his pants, who he seems very happy with. He seems happy with the job he does as a pant maker.
Yeah.
But you really get a flavor for who Lyndon Johnson was in this phone conversation. And just keep in mind, this is the leader of the free world talking to a guy who just got a phone call saying, hold for the president. So he's terrified.
Yeah.
And this is what happens next. I think we're going to start a few minutes into the conversation after Johnson has specified color and that he likes them to be lightweight fabrics. Then he has some specific things that he wants this tailor to watch out for.
The pockets, when you sit down in the chair, the knife and your money comes out, so I need it at least another inch in the pockets. Yeah. Now, another thing, the crotch down where your nuts hang is always a little too tight. So when you make them up, give me an inch that I can let out there because they cut me. It's just like riding a wire fence. These are almost, these are the best that I've had anywhere in the United States. But when I gain a little weight, they cut me under there. So leave me, you never do have much margin there. Let's see if you can't leave me about an inch from where the zipper ends round under my back to my bunghole. So I can let it out there if I need to. Now, be sure you got the best zippers in them. These are good that I have. And if you get those to me, I would sure be grateful.
All right.
And this isn't an old, when he was in his 30s before he was president. He was president when this happened. This is him, full-on president, recording this.
And this poor Taylor is speaking to the president, the leader of the free world, as he burps and talks about his bunghole.
Yep.
Talks about down where his nuts hang.
There's 100 amazing things about this clip. I love, he knows that he's talking to a tailor, and he admits that it's a tailor who makes the best pants in all the United States, but he still describes the crotch as if he's talking to an alien, as if like, oh, you'll never, if I say crotch, you won't know, so I'll have to mention my nuts and my butthole.
Also, you had pointed out that he talks about how when he sits down, things fall out of his pocket. Not just anything.
Yeah, it's the pockets are too small because when you sit, your knife and your money fall out. That's right. The only thing that he wants this tailor to know that he carries on him at any time.
The only thing that anyone carries in their pockets, your knife and your money.
Yeah.
Dan, I guess my question for you would be, who was this lunatic who was president and also apparently only carried knives and money in his pockets?
He was just a very effective politician forever. He was Senate leader and got so much done as Senate leader. And it's because I could say that the nerdy way that he studied up on all of his opponents and he knew everything about every senator and he knew every bill inside and out. Or I could say in his own words that he knew every single senator from eyeball to asshole. That's a direct quote of this man who became president.
So he's implying that he knew what their assholes looked like.
He did. He knew exactly what they looked like. He could pull them out of a lineup. There were a lot of times where people would just see him on the street and hold up a picture of an asshole, and he's like, that's Governor George Wallace. I know that.
I think you've written about specifically on the site this referring to his nuts excessively for no discernible reason was something that he was kind of fond of doing, right?
I mean, not for no discernible reason. He did it because they were super rad.
He
just really liked them. He talked about his wiener a lot. He nicknamed it Jumbo. And would take it out in meetings. And there's one of the weirder stories. This reporter was interviewing him about why we were in Vietnam and not getting the answers he wanted. And finally, Lyndon Johnson took down his pants and pulled out what the reporter called his substantial organ. And Lyndon Johnson said, "This is why we're in Vietnam." And the craziest thing about it is the reporter was like, "Okay." That clears it all up for me.
Really?
Yeah.
That was the thing that happened?
That happened. It's in Robert Dalek's biography of Lyndon Johnson.
Who was this reporter reporting for?
Highlights Magazine. I don't know.
how did he not flip out and make that into a... I guess that was part of the whole JFK thing. JFK slept with a bunch of women and the press covered it up for him and Lyndon Johnson used his penis as a prop?
Speaking of JFK and women, that was something that made Johnson furious. When people talked about what a womanizer JFK was, Johnson said, I'm going to try to get the exact quote, "I've had more women accidentally than JFK ever had on purpose." He was mad that Kennedy got the reputation as a womanizer when Johnson was apparently just crushing it in his sleep.
Accidentally?
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to brag about. I keep accidentally sleeping with these women. One thing that I was shocked by was that I guess I assumed stupidly that presidents always just had the Oval Office being recorded for the purposes of transparency. That's not true.
Right. He didn't do it for transparency. He just, as soon as he took office, started setting up recorders around all of his phones and would cue his secretaries, "Hey, I'm about to start talking. I want you to take this down." And he didn't do it for any reason of like, "Oh, let's put this in this presidential library so people could see what it's like to be the president." He would just do it because he liked it and would print out transcripts and read them to himself in bed at night.
That's really weird. That's really funny to me to imagine before he ordered those pants that he signaled to his secretary, "Okay,
you're gonna want to get this.
Yeah, you're gonna want to be taking this down. Going to talk about my butt." I watched this History Channel clip on YouTube, and they said that he started recording 30 minutes after Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah, immediately after he took office.
Going into this whole vice presidential thing, he knew he wanted to eventually be president, and once he became president, he would record everything. And there's like this creepy, I mean, it's not creepy, it's a really nice conversation he has with Rose Kennedy, where he's like, I just want you to know how sorry we are, and she's distraught. But he's recording it.
Yeah.
Like a creep would.
Like either an egomaniac or a total creeper would.
Right. And then he took that recording, had it transcribed, and then read it to himself before going to bed that night. That's really unnerving to me.
I mean, there are a couple of competing theories. I say competing like a bunch of people are talking about this. I have a bunch of theories in my head for why he was doing this kind of thing. Part of it could be his huge ego. I mean, he was one of the only people.
His ego, a nickname for his.
Yeah. Right. His giant, massive, swinging ego. He's one of the only presidents we've ever had, and probably will ever have, who was acutely aware of how cool it was to be the president. He was someone who in grade school said he wanted to be the president, and when he was addressing troops in Vietnam, he was turning to leave, and someone said, hey, Mr. President, which one of these helicopters is yours? And he said, son, all of them are mine. That's what you say when you know that you're the president and you know how cool that is. Everyone else, they downplay the coolness of the office. They're all doing that Washingtonian mold of, oh, I didn't want to be the president. It was thrust upon me by the people, and
it's a solemn
stepped
duty.
Up to answer this call. I serve at the pleasure of the people. Lyndon Johnson just wanted it and got it and records himself so he could sit in bed at night and be like, oh, look at how presidential I am. Look, listen to how fucking great I am. Oh, that was great when I said nuts to that kid.
Yeah, you can almost hear it in his voice a little bit there. As he's making this guy listen to him be unpleasant, and he's taking a lot of pleasure in it. There's this other recording that I want to listen to really quickly. I think it's during his campaign to be president, to actually get elected president, in 1964, and they just took a beating in some public debate. So he starts out talking about how he heard they just had a disaster, because he pronounces everything intentionally Southern in a way that Southern people don't actually pronounce things, but he wants you to know he's from Texas. Yeah. He's talking to this senator, and then he tells this anecdote that is described on the title of the YouTube link as a dirty joke.
Plant? Yes, sir. Tell me that we had a kind of a disaster up there, sir.
We had an awful bad day.
Did you ever hear about the fellow that's bending over, holding his ankles? The fellow that captured him tied his hands to his ankles, and he was bending over, holding his ankles. And the fellow came in, looked at him, kind of sized him up, and started pulling his zipper down. And the fellow said, oh, my God, said, please don't do this to me. Said, oh, damn, I've got enough hell, and you see what they've done to me. And said, please, just have mercy on me. And the fellow looked at him and said, I'm afraid part of this just ain't your day.
All right.
Who's the senator that's like, oh, yeah, I see where this silent joke is going.
Why would he have heard of that story? Right, that's just a story of a man who's being sodomized.
When he really doesn't want to be.
Yeah.
President Johnson starts off with like a classic joke set of like, oh, did you hear the one about,
right,
did you hear this? And I'll lighten the mood with, right, this charming
with this story. So as I understand it, there's a guy who's been captured, has his
hands tied to his ankles.
Hands tied to his ankles, right.
Three or four times it's mentioned.
And then another guy comes in and starts zipping down his fly, announcing his intention to sodomize the first guy,
right,
who has his hands tied to his ankles.
Yep.
And the guy begs him not to do that because he's really uncomfortable being held against his will. And the guy says, nope, I'm going to rape you.
Yeah, it's not your
day.
That's
the story.
I mean, that's classic. Laurel and Hardy did that.
The senator was like, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, I heard this one. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I guess I'll let you finish. Obviously, I know the punchline where the guy says, no, I'm going to rape you anyways. That's just how Johnson rolled, apparently. This idea that both he's telling his secretaries to roll on these conversations immediately before we hear this stuff, and that story and the one of him ordering pants suggest to me that this is like a very studied thing, that he was kind of playing an idiot or using this sort of Southern folksy charm to keep people disarmed.
He did, and I think studied is the right word. That is another competing theory in my mind for why he printed them out, because One of the things that LBJ was also known for was if he ever had a senator or an opponent that he knew was going to challenge him on something, he would read everything about that guy. He had a dossier on absolutely everyone in Washington. He would confront someone and do what was called the Johnson treatment, where he would use his, he's 6'3", so he would just loom over someone and use all of the things that he knew about them, all of their weaknesses and all of their shortcomings. This is what you want, and I could take it away from you kind of thing, and just blindside them with all the information he had on them. And it's not unreasonable, I don't think, to assume that he did the same thing for himself. He would go and study his transcripts. Now let me figure out this Johnson guy. What are my weaknesses? What are my strengths? What elicits a better response? Is burping testing well among young tailors?
Right. It seems like he gets away with a lot and got away with a lot, including pulling his penis out.
He made people watch him poop.
What?
He was talking to someone. It was a negotiation tactic. It was some uppity guy who was trying to give Johnson the old runaround. Johnson was like, oh, follow me. We'll continue this conversation. And he followed him into the bathroom, and then he sat down and started pooping. And the guy had to just sit there and bear witness to all of this and just be in that room. And that's probably the greatest power play that exists. This is how little I respect you.
Just locked in eye contact.
Tell me this thing that's important to you while I poop. Right. You have most of my attention.
6'3", grunting president just making unblinking eye contact with you. I can see how that would be effective. There's audio of he and his wife talking where she just critiques a speech he gave.
Listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till
tonight? Yes, ma'am. I'm willing now.
During the statement, you were a little breathless, and there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. In general, I'd say it was a good B+.
It's just so funny to hear him be so disarming and crude on these recordings and then very image conscious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another piece of context that I didn't know going into this was that the reason that we have these tapes at all already, I guess, they were supposed to be released in like 2037 or something. And Oliver,
which is a really specific year. It makes me curious what
or something.
His plan is. It's 2030 or 2037, something like that. That Lyndon Johnson was like, America will be ready now. Like,
right.
This is part stage two of my giant plan.
They had to release it early because Oliver Stone's JFK came out and made everybody really suspicious of LBJ as possibly being part of a conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy. So they put these tapes out to kind of reassure people for the sake of transparency. Like, he recorded everything that he ever said in the office, which obviously, like we said earlier, isn't true. He selectively chose these moments to record.
He couldn't have shot Kennedy. He was farting on his dentist at the time.
Right, exactly. I feel like that is the ultimate argument that these tapes make for him not being involved is, look at him. He's just a big goof. He's talking about his bunghole. It's hard to reconcile a guy who's talking about his bunghole with a guy who, I haven't seen JFK in a long time, but I think that he was supposed to be up to some sinister stuff. Yeah. And actually, there's this clip of the biographer who, I think he's written 5 books based off of all the tapes that Johnson took of himself. He went on some CNBC show and they asked him, so there's this one part of your book where Johnson says, as VP, he says, yeah, well, it's great that I'm VP. You know, people think VP is a shitty job, but it's actually a great job because if JFK gets assassinated, then I don't have to get elected president. I can just become president, which is a really hyper sinister thing to say.
It's like, super sinister, and it's still a far outside chance. It wasn't like, well, 50% of presidents die and then vice presidents step in. There were 6 at the time that Johnson chose to be vice president. So it's not even like, as cracked editor-in-chief Jack O'Brien is suggesting, Lyndon Johnson shot John F. Kennedy.
Hey, man, I'm not saying he did. I'm not saying he didn't. I'm sure all the conspiracy theories are crazy, but this is like probably the most high-profile, supposedly unsolved murder of the 20th century. Here's a guy who is expressing a motivation for wanting to do it, and it happens on his home turf. He's from Texas. And so there's just like these weird red flags that are probably total coincidences. And the biographer just, here, actually, we're going to cut to the audio of that Morning Joe appearance from LBJ's biographer.
I'm curious about, you look at him as vice president, actually doing the math and having staff members look up how many presidents died in office, admitting in many conversations that such a route was his best hope of becoming president himself. Can you put that in context?
Sure, but it's not as evil as
yes,
that sounds.
Okay.
Johnson was a great calculator. He felt that no one from the South
not as evil as it sounds. It's very calculating.
By the Democratic Party in his
it's
lifetime.
Not evil, but here is what his supervillain nickname would be.
It's the big northern states that control the votes. So he felt a Southerner's best chance, and he said this, was to take the vice presidency. As part of this, he did have his staff look up, and he found that six vice presidents had succeeded because the presidency died. And when someone asked him, why'd you take the vice presidency, he does say, well, you know, six of them didn't have to get elected.
Oh, so it's not evil.
Yeah. He said that in response to, hey, he said that he became vice president because so many presidents die. Can you put that in context? Yes, yes. Well, what he said was he became vice president because presidents die. Like, said the exact same thing that she said. It was like, good question. Fantastic question.
But it wasn't evil. He's very calculating.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine then. But again, so that voice you're hearing is his biographer who has listened to every hour of every tape of Johnson. The content of what he says doesn't defend him in any way. He's like, yeah, well, the thing you have to understand about Johnson is he really wanted to be president and he would do anything to get what he wanted, but he's doing it while laughing and like,
yeah, it's crazy because everyone else is very tense and like nervous about it. They're like, yeah, he said that he was vice president because on the off chance that the president got shot, and then the president got shot, and the guy's like, well, that's Johnson.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think that's the effect that spending years listening to these tapes of this guy farting it up and referring to his penis as Jumbo would have on you. You just can't take him seriously.
So you think that's a practiced thing that Johnson did? I'm not trying to out you as a conspiracy theorist. Is this your assumption that he recorded himself and spoke this way as like a way to disarm people and to fool them into thinking he was dumber or folksier than he actually was?
He is the verbal Kent of U.S. history. I don't know that it was that premeditated, but the facts that were surprising to me that he started recording 30 minutes after Kennedy was assassinated, that he chose each of these recordings, that he had to signal to his secretaries, all right, start the tape rolling, before each one of these calls, and that he had them roll on these really silly, stupid exchanges. You know, not all of them are that. Sometimes he's worrying about Vietnam or talking about civil rights. That's something that we should probably say for context, something that I didn't really know about him heading into this was that he did more for civil rights than any president before him, that he got a lot of legislation passed, and I think he started Medicare or Medicaid or something. All less interesting than him pulling his dick out.
Yeah. He wanted to beat FDR. He looked at FDR as the greatest president we've ever had and just really wanted to beat that record.
Of legislation?
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
any legislation. And so there's a lot of good stuff on these tapes, but there's a lot of him just being a jackass. And it's just funny to me that he's sort of seen as this buffoon, or not buffoon, but just sort of a Southern goofball.
Yeah.
And that's really the biggest argument that I think pops up in people's minds when the conspiracy theory thing comes up. Is that crazy?
I don't think it's crazy. I'd be curious to know how much Johnson knew about Kennedy when he joined the ticket, because knowing that Johnson wanted to be president as desperately as he did, and knowing that assassination and death of a president was like fresh on his mind, I'm curious, because Kennedy was sick his entire life and his family and the press did a whole really good job of covering it up to the public. So no one really knew that he would smile and wave at people, and then as soon as he was out of sight, would get in a wheelchair and collapse into it. All of his bones were just fucked up. I think one of his arms was shorter than the other one, and it was causing him, he's been in immense back pain his entire life and was just always, always, always close to death growing up. There were so many doctors who said he wasn't going to live. Kennedy had it in his head, I'm going to die young, I'm going to die before I'm supposed to. That's why I'm going to work so hard at being a president. And I wonder how much of that he shared with Johnson leading into this. That would be really interesting for me to know if Johnson was like, well, because I'm a Southern guy, I'll only be president if I'm vice president and my president dies. This president is probably going to die. He's the guy I'm gonna hitch myself to.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that Kennedy went around in a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I could see him saying tons of things offhandedly about how it would be great if Kennedy died without actually orchestrating the biggest conspiracy of the 20th century. Something else that was interesting about Johnson is he was obsessed with the phone. He was like a phone guy before people had a phone in their house, and that was it. Johnson had phones built into tables and built into his car that he had on his ranch in Texas before car phones were even a thing. Mm-hmm. He had a phone built into, I think, a tree next to the hammock that he liked to.
Is that true?
Something like that. There was some quote from a guy who was like, I think Johnson was the only guy who ever had a phone built next to a hammock.
Wow.
So he had phones everywhere, loved to get on the phone with people, and also was recording all the conversations that he had, or at least a good portion, any that he wanted to have played back or read back to himself.
Yeah.
He would have it recorded.
And the biographer has heard so many of these that he can't hear them in any context resembling evil or malice. You know, it'd be like someone saying to one of us, hey, did you hear what Homer Simpson said about nuclear power? And you're like, yeah, but it's Homer. He's not a bad guy. There's not an angry bone in his body. Because we've seen Homer goof it up in buffoonery for the last, I don't know, 26 years or however long that show's been on.
Yeah, there's something very Clintonian about it. You know, the way Clinton will play up the Southern accent if he's talking to people who aren't bureaucrats, but I don't think he speaks with a very thick Southern accent behind closed doors. Using the idea of the slow Southern gentleman to his advantage, it's sort of this overwhelming persona.
Yeah.
Like you said, the Johnson treatment, he would kind of come in and overwhelm you with his personality until you kind of just agreed with whatever his point of view was.
When that was like brought up with him, and they said, hey, it sounds like you're standing over people and bullying them. You get a millimeter away from their face and you drive them to tears until they give you what you want. I love the way that he brushed it off. He said that it was nonsense and that's not true. I'd have to be some sort of acrobatic genius to carry it off. And the senator in question, he'd be pretty weak and pretty meek to simply stand there like a paralyzed idiot.
That's unbelievable.
He probably didn't do it in that voice of mine.
Right. That plays to what we're talking about him using this Southern charm and this, not charm, but his Southernness to sort of disarm people. And
he was more of a chameleon with the way he was. He was like an oil man when he was talking to guys from Texas, and he was an elitist liberal when he was talking to guys from New York or Holly Weird. His words.
Yeah.
What a cool guy.
Really awesome. I'm like implying that he was way more evil and calculating and probably a sociopath, but I came away from doing all this research just loving him.
Yeah.
Just being like, oh man, this guy like used the presidency like it should be used. Yeah, we're going to put a phone in it, like a secret phone and everything. I'm going to be secretly recording everything that goes on because then I'll use it to dismantle my enemies. And he got a lot of stuff done. When you just look at legislation that got passed in different presidencies, he's one of the most successful. What do you do? Okay, Medicaid. Medicaid, Medicare, the Voting Rights Act, other civil rights bills are things that I hadn't always associated with Johnson. I just thought of Vietnam.
You think about Vietnam, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so in summation, Dan, I guess you have a book coming out that is about all the presidents or just
every president except living ones, because I don't want the government to look into me for researching how to beat up standing or living presidents. I didn't want that.
And Dan has a reason to be hesitant about that. He has been contacted by the Secret Service.
Yeah, I was brought to the Secret Service's downtown Los Angeles office and interviewed as a suspected Superfly terrorist, I think is what they were referring to me at the time. And so,
are you allowed to talk about what the article was that got you
no,
in trouble?
You're not. I mean, they I asked them at the end of the interview where they concluded on their side with, are you going to get fired for this? And I was like, probably not. And then I said, hey, I'm really dumb for asking this, but can I write about this for the website that just got me in trouble? And they said, we can't legally tell you you can't write about this, but come on.
Right. Like,
okay, you got it.
All right. So Dan has been in trouble with the Secret Service is all you need to know.
I get stopped at airports a lot. I would say I fly a lot because I have family on the other side of the country. And I would say probably 80% of the time I fly, I get pulled aside somewhere for, let me just look at your passport and type numbers into this thing for a while. That happens to me all the time.
And the reason he's getting stopped is because he knows so much about the presidency.
Oh my God, so much.
He's considered a threat.
Because I know information like this wicked gem. Lyndon Johnson peed on a guy. That's what the government doesn't want you to know, America.
So would that be, I wanted to ask you to take us out on sort of the defining anecdote of Johnson's presidency after doing months of exhaustive research on this
guy. This is, if I could teach people one thing, it's that at like a function, a public thing where there are lots of people around, Lyndon Johnson took out Jumbo, his wiener, and peed on a Secret Service agent. He needed to pee somewhere, and this agent could block view. And the agent started to react much in the way that you or I would if someone was peeing on you.
Like directly on him?
Directly on him.
Didn't get pee on him. Was like, all right, I have to pee.
I have to pee and you're standing here. This is a good, you're like a tree.
This pee.
Yeah. And the Secret Service agent started to like, Mr. President, I'd prefer you didn't do that. And LBJ was like, it's fine, son. It's my prerogative. This is
And thus, Bobby Brown's my prerogative.
Yeah. This is on the list of things that presidents are allowed to do. Read your constitution.
So fucking amazing. That is the greatest use of presidential power ever. That's Lyndon Johnson. Right? I'm be fresh as hell if the feds watch. I'm be fresh as hell if the feds watch. I'm be fresh as hell if the feds watch. Drop top. Head bottom. All right, guys, before we get to footnotes, Dan, you were pointing out that he's somewhat chameleon-like, and we kind of made him sound like a crazy dummy on this podcast, and he said a lot of pretty smart things, too.
He did. He was a really great speaker when he wanted to be. I mean, we've heard him on the phone do the whole down-home, burping, dick-waggling, redneck thing, but he really could turn it on and off depending on who he was talking to. There's a conversation that he had with Governor George Wallace. Wallace was the one who sent police to beat up the protesters in Selma, Alabama, when they were marching to get the right to vote. Wallace sent police and attacked them. And so Johnson brought him to the White House to talk to him. And the quotes that I'm going to pull out of this conversation, they go from, here I am like a plain-spoken guy just talking to you, to I am very eloquent, I should be a poet kind of thing. So Johnson was saying that he wanted Wallace to get his people to support civil rights, get the people in Alabama to help get them the right to vote. And Wallace said, I can't persuade people. And Johnson says, don't shit me about your persuasive power, George, which I love that as like, we're just a couple of guys. I'm not the president.
Right.
I'm just a guy sitting here in this office, which by the way, he specifically had Governor Wallace sit on a couch that was lower than the chair that Johnson sat in. He positioned himself in a higher chair so he could.
I do that in every podcast recording. You'll notice that I'm towering over you.
Yes, it's very, very intimidating.
Was Johnson taking a shit during this conversation, just for the sake of context?
No, he was in a rocking chair in the Oval Office, which is a really great mixture of like, I'm just a down-home guy here in the most powerful room in the world.
Such a great piece of theater.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just sitting here on this rocking chair. I bet he was smoking a pipe too.
And later in that same conversation, it's going to sound like I'm reading because I am reading this quote directly because I love it so much. You got a lot of poor people down there in Alabama, a lot of ignorant people. You could do a lot for them, George. What do you want left after you when you die? Do you want a great big marble monument that reads, George Wallace, he built? Or do you want a little piece of scrawny pine board lying across the harsh Kalishi soil that reads, George Wallace, he hated? Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Yeah, that's what, if you had a writing staff writing the biopic for that scene into the Johnson biopic. That's,
right. This is Aaron Sorkin's Lyndon Johnson.
Right. That's really great. And he just came up with that off the cuff.
Yeah.
And then he probably like farted and itched his ass so that Wallace didn't think he was too smart. That's awesome. You've restored some dignity to the man. I tried to come up with the hip-hop soundtrack for Johnson, sort of what I would imagine would be the music playing in his head if he were a hip-hop fan and not dead. And so this is the footnotes section. Snuck up on you there. We opened up with There He Go, which is the whitest that song title has ever been pronounced. It's by Schoolboy Q, who we've heard from before, Collard Greens, on a previous episode. First of all, it's one of the rare songs that brags about being unassuming. You don't get that much in hip-hop. He starts off bragging that he's not wearing jewelry. has no bodyguard. I mean, I don't even walk around without a bodyguard. He's walking by himself through the mall. Not a thing that is cool anywhere to brag about, let alone in hip-hop. But he's secure in the knowledge that everyone he walks past is noticing him to the point of commenting on his aura of macho big-dickedness, you know? And that reminded me of Johnson, and it's just a cool song. Sort of this feeling of being followed around by a perpetual spotlight and just fucking loving it, you know, just like glorying in that. And then Feds Watching by 2 Chainz. This is Lyndon Johnson's theme song. Like most of 2 Chainz' writing, it's kind of stupid in a way that's actually really brilliant. I feel like 2 Chainz is the Yogi Berra of rap. And this song's thesis is that while 2 Chainz typically balls pretty hard, because he now knows that the feds are watching him, they're taking pictures of him, he's making an extra effort to just be fresh as hell so that he looks good for the cameras. He knows this is going on his permanent record, which is sort of our thesis for Lyndon Johnson. He knew he was recording these and he just liked to hear, listen to himself being fresh as hell when the feds watching. I think that was a direct quote, right? Is that in your book? Yeah, there, Dan?
Yeah, yep.
Dan, you want to plug your book? Where can people buy How to Fight Presidents?
How to Fight Presidents, you can go to howtofightpresidents.com and or just fightpresidents.com. I own them both. And there are links to Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Books a Million, everywhere that books are sold. You can pre-order it or pre-order the e-book version. And there's a lot of neat stuff about presidential genitals in there. We talked about Johnson's, but this is just the tip of the iceberg, which was Benjamin Harrison's nickname.
For his penis.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. So that is episode 8, and tune in next week for a different podcast. Watch out, true. Take the boy and never go up on the list on the right now. Move on. All that weed, that money, them move on. Grab everything. Grab everything. No, you don't move. You don't move. That's a nun. That's a nun. That's a clan. Move on. Move on. Before my tool of blood.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.